Paul Rodell again, IVS Oral History Project. It is now, I'm sure, September 2nd. And I'm here with Kenneth Steimer in his home in Bern, Indiana. You prefer Ken?
Ken, yes.
You do. Ken served in Laos in 1968 through 1970 in agriculture, and was in a number of different assignments, had a number of different activities, knew a number of different people. And that's basically what we're going to be talking about tonight. End of introduction. Now, okay, I can set that aside. And basically what I'm going to be doing now is turning things over to you after I ask the first question, because it's a doozy in terms of length, so that I can just sit back and listen to you and maybe interject and interact and ask something to clarify. But basically, what I've been trying to do anyway, I haven't listened to Mark's tape, so I don't know how he does things, but I'd prefer a kind of open-ended discussion where we're talking like we were earlier, just as two people, rather than an interrogation, you know, where I'm asking the questions and I want the answers. And you've got to be brief. And I don't want to do it that way. I'd rather just have a talk. But the first question we've been asking everybody is something about your own background that got you up to the point of considering something like IVS, whether it's that or IVS or Peace Corps or whatever. So where and when you were born, who your parents were, not just their names, but who they were as people, as influences on your life, as participants in the community, whatever, however you see them. And some of the influences that formed you as a young person, who by 1968 considered going overseas. And I can shut up and you can talk.
Okay. Born in 1945 in Wells County, Indiana. This area is a prime agricultural area, flat area. I was raised on a farm, which was general farming, livestock, as well as grain production. My father was a farmer. My mother is mainly a housewife. So both parents were on the farm when I was growing up. We had milk cows, as well as beef cattle, sheep. We had horses when I was, I raised horses when I was on the farm. From my community, I think I got a sense of connectedness to the land, appreciation for agriculture, and for the role it had in people's lives. As a youngster, I grew up, we didn't have television until I was in junior high. So I had a great appreciation for books. I read a lot. And one of my heroes was Tom Dooley, who was a medical missionary in Vietnam and Laos. As among as were other people I read in the books and that meant a lot to me and had a lot of influence on my life as far as my outlook, role with other people, and the concept of service. And the service, I think, became very strong even in high school times. In high school, I was active in the band, extracurricular activities. Beginning my high school career, I was in sports, but I didn't excel all that well, so I concentrated more on academics. I went to Manchester College, which is a Church of the Brethren, a liberal arts college, majoring in biology.
But that wasn't your family background.
No, neither one of my parents had gone to college.
Oh, I meant religious background.
Okay, religious background. I was raised EUB, which later became Methodist.
But you went to this Brethren College.
Went to this Brethren College, mainly because it had a good academic reputation. And at that time, I was studying biology, planning to go to medical school.
I just went back to the religion thing, because as soon as, you know, we get into a Brethren College, we might think, oh, he must have been Brethren.
Right.
You know, so I wanted to clarify that right now.
It was at the, I distinctly remember at Manchester in my freshman year being in speech class, and these strange characters talking about being pacifist, and that was a kind of a foreign concept to me, and I never did become what I would call a pacifist, but I was exposed, and I struggled with the conscientious objector stance. It was also at Manchester, I took history course under Dr. Edmund Burke, who was a former IVS team leader in Iraq. And at the end of my, towards the end of my college career, when I did not get accepted to medical school, I was facing the draft, and also during this whole time, I was very much orientated towards the service aspects and the global community, as we call it now. I don't know the term we had then.
And the service was from your own community where you were raised.
Well, that and exposure at college, too.
And also the Brethren influence.
The Brethren influence. Mm-hmm. It was in the 60s, a very intense time on the campus, of course, with the Vietnam War. But also a lot was stressed on the campus of service to the fellow human beings.
Because this wouldn't have come then so much from your own immediate family. Your father was a working farmer and took care of his family, but didn't get involved in the community that much.
Right.
And your mom, did she work outside the home?
No, she did not.
She was a homemaker, and again, she concentrated on the family and raising that, doing all.
Let's see. It was during this time at Manchester, my beginning of junior or senior year, I did see an advertisement or something about International Voluntary Services. I was immediately taken by the title. I did an inquiry, found out about the program in Laos. Of course, this appealed to me because of my previous readings of Dr. Tom Dooley and such. So I applied to IBS, was interviewed, and accepted.
Do you remember who interviewed you?
Rod McGray runs in my mind, I believe.
Oh, he's up in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
I miss seeing him.
Went to, I believe, Warsaw to interview at a hotel or something there.
Oh, just down the road on 30. Okay.
Warsaw or Plymouth, I'm not too sure. It's somewhere. During this time, I was struggling with the CO stance, and I was finally able to convince my draft board to allow me to be a conscientious objector. And it was after the whole struggle was over and got the clearance that my grandmother came up and said, "I'm so proud of you. You know, your grandfather was a CO during World War I." And I'd never known that. My grandfather was a Mennonite, but he was killed in a hunting accident when my father was 5 years old. So that story never got told, and I thought I was forging new ground for our family. So it was only new ground for me.
And earlier you told me that your grandmother, after your grandfather's death, joined a different church.
Yes, a local
church. So that had not, the Mennonite tradition had not been continued. Yep.
It broke that tradition, or otherwise I'd have probably been raised Mennonite and been exposed to that.
Much earlier, and it wouldn't have been a struggle of consciousness, so it was just by happenstance that you went to the Brethren School.
That's right.
Just for the academics, and got right back into the same milieu.
So what goes around comes around.
I guess it certainly does. It's an interesting pattern, you know, it really is.
Let's see, well, you want to continue on the narrative?
Yeah. Yeah, I can't think of, this has been a pretty clear, you know, thing about your background. And the influences, I should, I should tell you that more than one person has mentioned the books by Dooley.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And I too remember reading things like The Night They Burned the Mountain and other. He had about four, I think, four, maybe five.
Well, The Night They Burned the Mountain really made an influence because I saw mountains burn, mm-hmm. just as he described them.
Mm-hmm. For the agriculture.
Because I was in northern, I was in northern Laos in the highlands.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
We experienced that.
Yeah. So you do get Rod Cumming to give you a bit of an interview,
mm-hmm.
and you gain acceptance. Were you aware that IVS service could be counted toward alternative service for people with CO status?
Yes, I was aware of that.
Okay.
And so that all kind of worked together.
Mm-hmm.
It was
I know you didn't do that to seek that out, but it just so happens that mm-hmm. it fits.
So that fit together well, and I was much more interested in doing that than serving in a hospital in the States or such. And part of my struggle, even my sophomore year, I was about ready to quit college and join the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
I felt always felt a real strong obligation to country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I fulfilled that in the CO stance, but it was a different way of doing it. But I did come to that stance, and even though I was a CO, I did not feel that lessened my obligation to what was taking place to my country, as well as maybe more importantly, the local people involved in that in Southeast Asia. And so I saw it as a way of not avoiding the issues
mm-hmm.
of that
but
of that time.
Actually engaging in that.
But engaging it. And not hiding behind the conscientious stance.
Mm-hmm.
Though I don't think people that didn't go were any less sincere in their conscientious objector stance, but to me, I thought it was important that not be a way of hide from obligations.
Mm-hmm.
And I still felt an obligation, and I felt this was a way of doing something of a positive nature rather than of a negative, destructive nature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you made that point.
So,
did the draft board, do you think, were won over by this argument, or did you make this argument? About IVS as part of your CO discussion with them?
Oh, yes. I think that was probably the factor with the draft board, because I went to the draft board
mm-hmm.
and made a statement and telling them, that I had this job with IVS, that I wanted to go overseas in this very region. And so I know in their minds, they knew that I wasn't trying to dodge something. This was at a time when a lot of the fellows, and Deb's roommate, in fact, my wife's roommate, had taken the stance of non-cooperation. And ended up going to federal prison for that stance. And I admire him for that stance, but that's not my way. And the draft board was...
Deb's roommate?
Yes.
Not room.
One of her college roommates. Her boyfriend, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Her boyfriend, who married then, took a non-cooperative stance.
Oh, one of Deb's roommates, boyfriends. Oh,
yeah.
I thought you meant
became her husband.
Deb's roommate.
No, 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 I'm sorry. Glad we got that clarified.
Yeah.
In fact, we, so he went through that experience.
Yeah, uh-huh. And that's a gutsy one.
But at that time, the federal courts were facing issues just like this,
mm-hmm.
and I think that my draft board realized if they would turn me down, and if that would come to a federal court, and the judge finds out that I was trying to go to Southeast Asia,
the area where fighting is
yeah,
at least near, if not,
they wouldn't have been able to defend themselves at all, because mm-hmm. there was so many other cases of people non-cooperating or. They're not going to there.
Uh-huh.
So that was most likely a factor in their mind.
Well, yeah, I would think that it was, but I didn't know if you had discussed it with them as part of your defense,
Yes, I
or if you
did.
were just
That I had a
simply,
job set up.
yeah, that because frequently in those sessions, I think it's more from what I know of them, and I've never gone through one, but I understand their philosophical search, and the board is trying to find out how sincere and well thought out the person is.
One of the
So you didn't necessarily have to talk about
right.
ideas.
The summer before that, I worked in construction, and we had a project in Bluffton, Indiana, where my draft board was, and the gentleman was the local probation officer, and he was gung ho for the Vietnam War, and so we had interesting discussions all the time I was working in his house.
So you
And
knew him already?
yeah, so but he no, he wasn't on the draft board,
Oh,
but he
okay.
was well known in the community. And so when I filed my conscientious objector status, I used him for one of my references, and he had the best letter I think I could have had.
Really?
He said, "I believe that Mr. Steiner's sincere in his beliefs. However, I do not agree with him." And then he'd make another every other sentence. He said, "I do not agree with him, but I think he's sincere, you know." And so that was probably the best type of letter, because they knew that he completely disagreed with me. But
And they would have known him.
Oh yes, they knew him. He's very prominent.
Uh-huh.
By the way, in 79, came back while he had flip-flopped 180 degrees. And
By
his
1970.
yes.
So in space of less than 3 years.
When I left, there was a very strong feelings against conscientious objectors.
Yeah.
And it was, especially in a small rural community like ours, it was very much looked upon, even though there was a Mennonite influence in this community.
Yeah.
It was not stressed in the local Bern Mennonite church at that time. When I came back in 70, I was in Hong Kong on the way back when Kent State took place. And that was, of course, probably the turning point of public opinion. And another factor that I mentioned, I think, in my diary years before, that the public opinion will sway when every community is personally affected by a death in Vietnam. And that's about the point that we came.
Well,
Well, that's kind of
speaking of Mennonites, though, I mean, your current wife, who you were dating at the time and were already talking about, something substantial in your relationship. She had a Mennonite background,
she was
right?
Church of the Brethren background.
Oh, Church of the Brethren.
Yes, which is
Okay.
very close related to the
Okay,
Mennonite
I'm
choir
sorry.
service and
Yeah,
peace stance.
yeah, yeah. But
Yes.
you mentioned Mennonite, so I was thinking of that,
Yeah.
and then I made a jump to your wife. You met her at college.
Met her at college.
So she was part of this process of conscientious objector, just thoughts for yourself and in your own
Yes, we dated
thinking.
Her sophomore year, my senior year, when I was going through the really final phases of this struggle, and so she was part of that. We were very close during that time,
Yeah.
and so she was part of that. And then also, the 2 years I was overseas, we were in constant contact with letters and such. And then
Yeah.
subsequently got married, and I came back.
Yeah. And still down to today.
Yeah.
But no, I was trying to think of the complexity of all the things that went into your decision. So it's also very personal in the fact that of the woman that you're becoming very close to, and her religious beliefs and your discussions as not just a couple dating, but as two people who respect each other and their thoughts.
That's right.
And all of that baggage, as well as the baggage of the college and its environment, and yet your idea of service and the idea of international participation and Tom Dooley and such. So there's really a lot that went into this.
There's a lot of things that converged
Yeah.
that brought me to this point.
Yeah. A very interesting mix. That's not frequently shared, because I've talked to other people who were Brethren or Mennonite. That was very easy for them. And some people who came to it differently without the religious background too. So if we have a scale of things we check off for points, you're going to have a lot of checks.
A lot of brownie points, huh?
A lot of factor checks, whether it's brownie points or not. Yeah.
That sounds better.
Yeah. Anyway, you are at least aware of Laos as a country because of your readings of Dooley, and you've had some Asian history through the professor that you mentioned.
Right. I took a course in Asian history, and one quarter of that was Southeast Asia, Dr. Eldon Burke.
Mm-hmm.
So this provided me with a much more of a historical background than most people had coming to this situation.
Mm-hmm. And yet you were also anti-war, too.
Yes, I was. I had never taken part in any demonstrations or protests. Mm-hmm. That just wasn't my way. In fact, I'd always remembered advice I was given. I interviewed for FBI when I was in high school, and the agent told me, said, you know, stay away from these protests. You get caught into it, why, you're going to squelch any career in FBI.
Other parts of the government, too.
Yeah, as it turned out, it didn't make any difference. And, of course, I didn't go into that.
Yeah, you're in private industry down to today, but what the heck.
But to me, this stance was my way of expressing my witness.
Okay.
My beliefs.
Well, I hope we haven't beaten that first topic to death.
I hope it didn't get too boring for you.
No, my coming back to it might be beating it to death, not yours. I just noticed a television on top of a television over there.
Yeah, the one that doesn't work very well.
Yeah, so it becomes a table.
Yeah.
Okay, so as the new recruit, what month is this now? What, in terms of the chronological progression, when are you accepted into IVS, and when are you preparing to get into the organization now?
I think it was latter part of June, first part of July, if I remember right, when I left for Washington, D.C., and we went to Harper's Ferry. We had about a week at Harper's Ferry for orientation there.
How many of you in? Well, this was, I think, probably a combined group.
This was a combined team that was going to Vietnam and Laos.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so I imagine there were, 20 to 30 of us.
That many.
Maybe 20, 25.
Well, that's a sizable group. That's impressive. Mm-hmm. How many of this group went on to Laos?
It was about half and half, if I remember right.
Okay. Who from the Laos group do you remember being in your group? No. Who in your group do you remember as being Laos bound? That's
Fritz Benson was part of my group. Jim Beringer. Rich. Trying to think of his first name.
His last name was Rich?
Rich, I believe.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Well, I could look it up.
I believe he's in Singapore, last I heard.
Uh-huh.
Harvey, Rich Harvey. No, I'm sorry, Rich Harvey.
Okay.
We probably had some education people, but I've kind of forgotten them. Education people were kind of a different world than what we were in Laos.
How so?
They were living a different situation. They were either in the larger provincial cities are in Vientiane. Most of them were in Vientiane in more of a school setting, where we were in the remote stations. And so it, we were in a much different circumstances and circle of friends and such. We were more involved in local Laotians and community and of course, live more in a different security situation, so that provides a certain camaraderie of your like groups when you are together.
Mm-hmm. And you were also isolated.
We were isolated, yes. We were stationed, usually one other American. My first two stations, Hong Sao, Mon Cassi, I had one other American, and really the next closest American would be anywhere from 30 to 45 minutes by air.
Yeah. Let me pause for just a second here. I'm turning this thing back on again.
Okay.
And you, while we were off tape, you remembered somebody else in your group.
Ted Obrick.
Okay.
Was in our group.
And now you were just saying.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember, but it might have been about 20 people total between the IVS Laos and Vietnam group, and maybe about 10 of us went on.
Uh-huh.
And we probably had some education folks. I don't remember who was in the educational group.
Well, those are folks that who then would have gone into.
They were
Vientiane and Luang Prabang and
yeah,
some of the other large cities, and you would have lost contact.
Right. Where these other fellows were in the agricultural, and we were in, some of them were what we called the forward, they labeled the forward area programs.
What did that really mean, forward area?
Forward area program was the idea of, in Vietnam they had the phrase, winning hearts and minds of people through development.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in some respects we were used. Put it this way, if the U.S. military had had an open presence in Laos, the forward areas would have probably been staffed by civic action teams, military civic action teams.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay.
But since those people were not available, that's kind of the role that we were doing in Laos. It was areas that sometimes were marginal security-wise or had previously been under control of Pathet Lao and been reverted back to Royal Lao government control, and
mm-hmm.
the idea was to make a positive influence and win people to the Lao government side.
So it was deliberately putting you quite close to, well, into remote areas and sometimes quite close to Pathet Lao concentrations or areas of control.
Yes. Many times we had close proximity to Pathet Lao. In fact, in Mon Cassi, we would go in a village during the day, and we'd ask the woman, you know, well, where's her husband? Oh, he's with the Pathet Lao.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd observe that there was children of all different ages, and said, well, he comes sees me at night. And we had therefore the children. So we had a working relationship that our house was next to the military compound, about 2-3 kilometers away from the village. And we would work in the village during the day, but at night we would stay out.
And you'd be near the military compound.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And Pathet Lao knew we would, and they knew we'd be in the village during the day, and we knew they'd be in the village at night. And as long as we didn't cross paths, why, there'd be no problem.
How do you know that this was an agreement?
This was just kind of a gentleman's agreement that we had. Lorne Willie was there before.
Your predecessor.
Fellow been at Mon Cassi longer than I had. He was kind of understood that's the way it was.
So if there had been any agreement, he was the one who worked it out or knew the details of how it might have been worked out.
Yeah.
I mean, no, he certainly wouldn't have talked to the local Pathet Lao.
I don't know if there were any direct conversations even.
No, probably through intermediaries on both parts.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he would know that, I would suspect, if anyone was to know it.
Probably.
Okay. So, and of course he's overseas.
Right.
And we haven't contacted him about that. Okay. But, I'm sorry for that, a little bit of a tangent, but forward area is a term that's sometimes fuzzy, depending on the volunteer and the time and the geographic location. So it was, we have to develop definitions.
That term was being used less when I arrived. I think it was more in vogue prior to my being there.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, in fact, Hong Sa, there was a big sign on the IVS house, Hong Sa Forward Area.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was even a sign on the house.
And then later, what was it added? Not a forward area?
No, just stay there. In fact, the house was a plywood monstrosity and such that really did not blend in with the village. It was a house, it was rooms above, and then underneath was where our office was and such. So I don't think I ever did sleep in that house. We
really?
We slept in the other houses in the village. In fact, I built a small house for our sleeping quarters soon after I got there. We we bought a bamboo little bamboo house and mm-hmm. and took it down and moved it, and I made a 2x4 frame and such, and with a bunker underneath, but it was bamboo from the outside, so it would fit in a little better with for the decor. Because the IVS building there, if the Patalau came in, they'd had to hit it because they'd have lost face if they wouldn't have. It was just so obvious American. So we knew that if they come in to do anything, that they would hit the house. We fully expected that, so we did not sleep there at night.
Was that house raised up off the ground, or was that flat on the ground?
It was raised up off the ground, yes.
Just as all the other houses
yes,
were.
In fact, it was raised high enough that we had our offices on the ground floor.
I see. Yeah. So what did you do? Cement the ground and then?
Cement the ground and made an office there.
Okay. Because I thought I had this vision of a regular kind of house like we would have here of two floors. And I was thinking how odd that must have looked in that village.
Well, it looked odd anyway.
But yeah, I'm sure it looked odd anyhow.
And again, it was close to the military compound.
Okay. Yeah, I just a mental image that mm-hmm. that was in my head, and I thought, gee, that's kind of weird as a house, because I wanted to get some sort of definition of the idea of a forward area. This is about out of. Because one name that's associated with that is a Colonel Hafner, and you mentioned him over dinner. Is that H-A-F-N-E-R.
F-N-E-R,
yes. Okay. Did you actually ever meet him?
Yes, and he wasn't an actual colonel, but that's what we called him.
Oh, he wasn't actually a colonel?
No.
Oh, I thought he was.
We just nicknamed him. Well, he might have been at one time. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
He was a civilian at the time I was there.
No, I mean, he was AID. Right?
But he was AID. He
right.
was a gun-ho AID.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How old was he then?
Oh, gosh, he seemed like he's in the 60s. He might have been 50s. I don't know.
Because I was wondering if he might still be alive.
Possibly. He would be getting pretty old, though, if he would be.
Okay, because you... But he had been retired from military, right?
I assume so, but I can't say for sure.
Okay.
That's kind of a reputation he had.
So he got his full bird status by his persona.
Right.
Rather than anything else.
We had a lot of characters in Laos. Not on IVS, but in aid especially.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some retired military types really ate up the adventure of it and,
mm-hmm.
and that type of thing.
Do you know what Hafner's first name might have been?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I probably have it somewhere. But.
All right. No, I was just going to...
I don't think I do have it.
Yeah. I was going to go back to Washington sometime and see if they... have any information on Hafner, just in a biographical sense.
AID probably would have.
Yeah.
I don't think he was ever IVS.
No, not with IVS, but with AID. Mm-hmm. And so far we've been concentrating on IVS exclusively. But that would only be half the story, or it's more than half the story, but not the full story. So I was interested in this guy because I had heard his name before. Yeah, because I think...
In fact, when we were in Moncasie and we were evacuated out of there because of North Vietnamese coming in, Lauren and I made the decision in the afternoon to evacuate. In fact, I had to push Lauren pretty hard. And I don't know if it was a written rule, but it was kind of an unwritten rule, if nothing else. If either team member called for evacuation, the other had to go with it.
Mm.
And obviously, if the security situation is so bad, if one member feels it's untenable, why IVS went the other one out. I was underhanded on Tom and Hong Saw to get him out. I had to call Bob Lovin and assess him about the situation, and Bob called back a little later with a message ordering us out because Tom was, it was a case that I would not have been able to argue. It would have been a big argument, and wouldn't have gotten anywhere. But by being ordered out by Bob, that's how I
run this by me again, because you lost me. Maybe we should back up.
I got two different things here.
Yeah. In fact, maybe what we should do is do these kind of assignment at a time. The first assignment was where?
Was in Hong Sa.
That was the first one. Okay.
And Tom Tufts was there. And
he was your partner in that position.
He was a partner there. Jim Archer was there, who I replaced, but there was about 3 month overlap before Jim left.
Okay.
Tom was...
you just mentioned Tom.
Yeah, he was... as we said, pretty much more went bamboo. Mm-hmm. Then totally in the village level, local dress.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit, quite an eccentric person, I guess.
But a bit eccentric.
He was difficult to get along with, and I think IVS maybe saw that I could get along with most people, so that's the only reason mm-hmm. I was sent there. But when our security became untenable, and we had a problem with that because it was starting to relate, the rule, whether official or unofficial, was if one IVSer called for an evacuation away, they had to go. And our security in Hong Sa getting bad.
How did it get bad? I mean, what?
Of appeal activity, Katalao activity.
Well, how did you know this? What made you say this is too bad? Was there anything specific or?
Frequency of incidents, military incidences in the valley, mm. they were getting closer, and rumors that we were not able to disprove. We had to spend a lot of time checking out rumors. There was all kinds of rumors, and most of them were unfounded, but you always had to run them down and try to see if there was a validity.
Because you only need one.
You only need one to come true to in your career.
Mm-hmm.
So
in your life.
Yeah, that's what I meant. So the situation with Tom was he was hard to deal with on these manners, and so I called Bob Levin up on the radio and I told him, and of course Hong Sa was a very high concern among IBS as well as the embassy because mm-hmm. of our security situation. So it was everyone was very concerned. In fact, we knew we were going to be closing out. We were going to have to get out. The question, we didn't know how soon when. Art Stillman was going to come visit me. He became associate chief of party for the area. And I told him, I said, Art, I don't want you to come. We're getting ready to close out. And in that case, it's not worth the mm-hmm, risk mm-hmm. to your life.
So and your time.
Right. So... we had an incident. I forget what the incident was. Precipitated. I called Bob and told him, Bob, I got some. We're going to have to get out, and I'm going to have a hard time dealing with Bob. Please call me.
With Tom.
Tom mm-hmm. said, please call back and order us out.
Uh-huh.
And so Bob did that.
And Tom didn't know anything about that.
Tom does know to this day. So.
Oh, really?
So use a little discretion on that.
Yeah. Well, I've already interviewed him, and I.
Okay.
He's up in Boston.
Okay.
And I met, just pause this while I tell you, his life and what he's doing now.
Yeah, I'm interested.
We might tell a Tom Tufts story here.
Yeah, we were, Tom had crossed a baby elephant. And they say elephants never forget. And in Hong Sa, the streets were fairly narrow, and there'd be kind of alleys, and they'd be bamboo fence along. And I don't know what happened. Anyway, this elephant did not have a very good liking of Tom, and it saw Tom coming down the road, and so it literally backed in a side street, and Tom get there. Then it would charge out and try to knock him over. So we had the biggest laugh at this baby elephant trying to get the best of Tom. Give the other Tom Tufts story.
Oh, yes, that's wonderful. Oh, God.
I'd received from my parents...
this was a story, by the way, told over dinner, and we were all chuckling.
A gag jar that looks like has printed on the outside like it's peanuts, and it rattles, and you open it up, and a spring pops out,
Kind of like that snake
so,
thing.
Yeah, snake thing. So we would shake it and hint aloud, and they'd open this up, and they'd get a kick out of it. Well, Tom and I were in the Jeep. I was driving, and our local Lao colonel, military commander, was along the road. So Tom says, hey, stop here. I want to see the colonel. And I thought, oh, no, Tom. No, no, not now. Sure enough, Tom rattles his can, hands it to the colonel, and says, Colonel, have some peanuts. The colonel opened the lid. The snake flipped out. The colonel never flinched. Looked straight at Tom, boring through him with his stare, said absolutely nothing. After a minute, Tom got out of the Jeep, could barely get past the colonel where he was standing, picked up the jar, all the parts, got in the Jeep, said, Ken, let's go, and we left, and the colonel was still staring at him.
Didn't know who could take a joke.
Yeah, there was no humor in that.
Oh gosh. So anyway, you're in Hong Sa, and how long had you been there by the time this decision that you made and that you got Bob Lovin to support you in? How long did that take to work itself out? Or how long were you there by the
I'm
time that worked itself out?
I'm thinking I was in Hong Sa almost a year. I have to look up in my journal for sure.
Almost a year.
Or last after I got in Laos. It might have been a little shorter time than a year.
Okay.
Another thing that might be interesting in Hong Sa, kind of a cultural difference, different thing. The Lao had a thing about the feet. We would never touch someone's foot or such. And we had an Addo fellow. Addo.
That's that rice program to
develop. Agriculture Development Organization. They provide fertilizer and credit to the farmers to raise rice. And we had a Laotian.
Part of an export attempt?
Well, more of a farm credit
co-op type
of thing. And they had a local fellow there was their agent. And we were moving some rice, supposedly moving rice. And we had the three trucks in the valley. We get truck support. And E.J. Johnson and Sire Bree was the aide Addo fellow. It was this guy's overseer, but he would come up frequently and cause of that. And we had an incident where they weren't getting work done, and I found the fellows, and they were underneath the truck sleeping. They were supposed to be hauling rice. And I'm coming from a more of a Western culture. You keep working and such, you know. And I went up. And as soon as I did it, I realized I was really screwed up. To wake this fellow up, I kicked his foot.
Oh.
And I had committed probably the worst transgression one could ever commit to another human being in Laos. And I realized I had goofed up. So we had a situation there. And I had Udama was my Laotian fellow worked for me, and so I went to Udama.
What was the relationship?
Was our employee. He was actually became, I think, later IBS, local IBS employee, but he was kind of our assistant, administrative assistant in Hong Sa.
Okay.
He was Laotian. So I went to Udama.
So he wasn't like with a government agency with?
No,
as a co-worker?
He worked for us.
Okay.
He was not a counterpart.
Right.
He worked for us. So I went to Udama and explained to him, you know, what happened. I said, Udama, what can I do? And he says, I'll have to go talk to Chow Mo, the district officer. So that was interesting. He went and talked to Chow Mo. And of course, as it turned out, the Chow Mo gained a lot of stature in this whole situation because he became the mediator between the American and the Laotian on this incident.
Yep.
So the Chow Mong, his prescription was that we would have a basi, and I would have to, of course, provide the lao lao and the chicken and such. And, the Chow Mong would host it at his place, and we invited different village elders and such to this. So that's what took place, and that was our reconciliation. And remember, EJ saying, you know, you shouldn't bother this guy's a zero, and I need to get rid of him anyway. But I didn't look at it that way. I I was wrong. And I had made the transgression, so I wanted to see if there was a way that I could rectify that within their culture. And so Udama, mm-hmm. with the Chamung, worked that out. And so we were reconciled in that way.
And it worked.
It worked. Mm-hmm. And I relate it because, not necessarily build myself up, but I think it's so many times Americans lose that sensitivity. And we
or don't have it to begin with.
Or don't have it to begin with. We got to remember we're still their guest.
Mm-hmm.
It's their country. So of course, I always remember that. And I hope it was a positive thing for them, too. I think sometimes we need to admit when we're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And see if there is a means of reconciliation. Well, where we go from
here? Yeah. Well, no. I was wondering, because you're making a statement really about our own culture and its limitation when dealing with people of other cultures, and that's an important statement. And you said that frequently when we go overseas, we forget that we're guests. We forget that we have to be sensitive to their culture. We forget or don't even know or our own blindness about the value of our own culture blinds us to the fact that other cultures might have value too.
Right.
At least that's what I hear you saying. And I was wondering how you might go from that general statement down to some of the specifics that you may have observed in the U.S.-Laotian dynamic at that period that might have made the working relationship between the United States and Laos not go well. For example, between AID representatives and Laotian counterparts and U.S. military or whoever.
I think that was one of the big problems that the U.S. military had.
Mm-hmm.
Of the cultural differences and how to relate to that. Most of the military, direct military in Laos, was at the military attaché level, the colonel level.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite the same as you had in Vietnam.
But and that's almost excusable in Vietnam, because then 18-year-old kids, what do they know? And they're on leave, and they're
yeah.
drinking for the first time, and they're acting dumb, but they would have acted dumb in the United States. But a colonel should know better.
Yeah, and they were a little more sensitive, but many times they, I think, were not sufficiently aware of cultural differences and such, and there was misunderstandings and this type of thing. One of the favorite stories that circulated, I don't know if that had any merit or not, but it's a great story.
It might have merit
in that
only as an example of a truth.
It's maybe like a myth, an expressive truth. And the story goes in southern Laos that the Laotian military commander was shelling a certain area, and his American attaché assigned to him raised holy cane with him, because you know the Pathet Lao aren't there. You need to shell this other coordinates. That's where the Pathet Lao are. So mm-hmm. he changed aim in his guns and shelled that area. That night, he had a messenger on his door, and it was a messenger from his counterpart on the Pathet Lao, and saying, hey, you're really knocking the crap out of us. You're shelling our area. You're hurting us. I realize maybe you have to do this to satisfy your American Adish military advisor. But if you keep this up, my Vietnamese advisor is going to make me come in and attack you. So here's another set of coordinates. You drop in here, I'll move my people out of there, and we'll keep everybody happy. And they did. So that was for the incident probably took place. Whether it did or not, he expressed a lot of the truth. The Laotians were involved in a war that they really didn't have that much of a personal stake in. This is a conflict between Vietnam and the United States. It was an extension of the historical conflict between Vietnam and Thai. The story in Laos was when the buffaloes fight the grass gets trampled, and Laos is the grass. And so Laos had traditionally been the battlefield between those powers over the centuries. So too many times it was an extension of that. A lot of times we would get concerned about the military situation, and I remember Hong Sa was expressing concern to villager that, you know, if we leave, why he might be in danger because of his association with us. His comment was, never mind, bumping young, makes no difference. The French were here, they left, the Japanese came, and they left, the Americans came, and you'll leave, and Pat Lau will probably come, and we will still grow our rice, and our children will still go to school. And so to them, and at that level, in that remote area, he was probably right. It didn't make a whole lot of difference who was in control.
So. Yeah, and whether he had associations with Americans.
Yeah, and for a military attaché to come in and talk about democracy and freedom and a free world and such, that had no meaning whatsoever to that village.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, yeah. Worse than a foreign language.
Yeah.
Because it's a foreign concept.
That's right.
Yeah, the language, if it shares the concept, you can learn the language, but yeah, if the concept is different, you're in trouble.
Yeah, where were we?
Yeah. So, no, I think
Hong Sa, it's... Hong Sa was, maybe I might mention.
Oh, okay.
Hong Sa was kind of a unique situation. I arrived there because apparently a year or two before, the director of aid or some high aid official was up there, and the crown prince of Laos was there,
mm-hmm.
got him drunk, and got him to promise a full development program for Hong Sa. Well, a promise made has to be a promise kept.
Uh-huh.
Even in spite of it was not a good idea because of margin security.
Mm-hmm.
So they went to full bore development program, and the objective was to supply rice to Luang Prabang. It was a classic development as far as you make a road from the Mekong River, build a road down to Hong Sa. You bring in the fertilizer inputs, the new practices, the IR-8, and you would produce rice and ship it down to Luang Prabang, who was at that time importing from Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the program was off to a good start. They built the road. They got the farmers to plant the rice. The Hong Sa farmers were very progressive, open to new ideas. They planted the rice. They got all this extra rice crop. And by the time his race sent it up to the river to market, to Patat Lao, then of course closed the road down. So when I arrived there, I remember, I believe Val Peterson, or one of my associate chief of party at that time, telling me that you have, whatever it was, so many weeks, forget the number they gave, to get rid of this rice, or we'll have to pull all of you out. It's going to be unhealthy for you.
To get rid of it, you mean to sell it? Or?
To sell it, move it out, to get this, because the rice is being stored in the villagers underneath their houses. They weren't paid for it.
Okay.
And it was very unpopular at that point because they had gone into the program and then there was no market as they were promised.
Uh-huh, okay.
So I found out that Refugee Relief was supplying rice to refugees, and really the distinction between refugees and military dependents was pretty fuzzy. But they were supplying rice in our general area and flying it from Vientiane in Caribou aircraft.
Just to clarify, the fuzziness between refugee and military dependent, why was that fuzzy?
Okay. Usually, in our popular concept, we think of refugee who has fled their home and has gathered in a certain area to be cared for.
Mm-hmm.
Refugee Relief was taking care of those people, but the Refugee Relief operations in Laos was also applying food to dependents of the military. In Lao military, the family traditionally would stay with their mm-hmm. husbands who were soldiers. They would live in the same military compound. So it was always an interest to supply them and keep them happy so there's... their husbands would stay there and defend that
okay.
that particular area.
And this was Lao, not Hmong?
Hmong.
Oh, this was Hmong. Okay, all right.
Yeah. So I got the idea of, well, we got all this rice, and it's less than a fourth of the airtime to supply it from Hong Sao, so why don't we do that? And it took a little doing and such, but I finally prevailed to get that accomplished. So mm-hmm. we literally organized rice drops flying out of Hong Sao. And about this time, I had a group of refugees come into Hong Sao, and so I was feeding and supporting them. So I used them for the labor to bag the rice for the airdrops.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we got rid of our rice. So we ran a lot of airdrops. Some of the aid people weren't too happy because I was kind of short-circuiting some of the things they wanted to do. They had their own program going. So we usually try to take Sundays off, and it seemed like every Sunday, they'd call up Sunday morning our radio check and say, by the way, you're going to have a caribou to fly rice out today. So, but we got it out anyway.
Well, it sounds to me, though, that they should have been happy with this, because it's getting rid of the rice, so therefore the program can continue unless they wanted it to shut down.
The IRA was not the rice that the Laotians were used to eating.
Oh, no, that's true.
Moment.
Yeah.
And so there was some of the reluctance to accept the IRA rice.
But that's not AID.
Well, AID was supplying the rice.
Yeah. But I mean, AID, I thought you were implying that AID was not exactly happy with the way you were getting rid of the rice, that it interfered with some of their other
problems.
Well,
they was...
Or the other projects, excuse me?
As far as the acceptability of rice to the folks receiving it,
mm-hmm.
And then we were dealing with a bureaucracy, and they don't like to change. Bureaucracies do not like to
change. Oh, okay.
Like
All right.
Maybe a key point here, IVSers, unless you were bucking for a job with AID,
mm-hmm.
You could really be one way of a thorn in the side of aid people, because if you weren't bucking with a job with aid, you could work the bureaucracy, you could work the system,
mm-hmm.
And what are they going to do to you? They're sitting there making $80 a month. They're going to demote you. The worst thing to do is send you home, and they got to have a pretty good reason for doing that.
Uh-huh.
I had a situation in the irrigation project. It was a great irrigation project. They built a gabion dam with labor input. The only outside input was hog wire and a little concrete. The villagers, by hand, drove pilings, they put in stone, we provide trucks to haul the stone and such. They dug approximately 1 mile of canal.
Ooh.
It was a tremendous undertaking. Only had one small problem, the canal went uphill. The irrigation team they had had the slope wrong. Well, the
ooh.
The head of the irrigation project in Vinchon, he had a solution for it. The water would get about halfway up the canal, and you put in a lift pump, and it would make it the other rest of the way. At least that was a concept. Engineering-wise, it was a good solution.
Mm-hmm.
However, Hong Sao did not have its own gasoline supply. All that had to be flowing in. They did not have mechanics. This fellow brought in a pump and providing a Jeep engine to run it. And as we as IVSers were talking to villagers, they said, you know, we don't want anything to do with this. So there was
what was the villagers' rationale?
Because they couldn't maintain it.
Okay.
They
so
knew,
they knew already that
they
this
knew
is
already
going to be a temporary thing. The first time it breaks down is the last time it
they
works.
They knew it wouldn't work.
Yeah.
So they were going. They hadn't dug complete. I don't think they had all the canal dug, but it was. It might not have been a mile, but it was a very, very big project
mm-hmm.
for hand labor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they were ready to pull the plug on a project.
Mm-hmm.
And this individual was Mr. Latham, I think was his name. So this was his solution, and I wrote my monthly report, the villagers' feelings, and that the project shouldn't proceed. And, of course, one of the things in monthly reports go throughout the aid bureaucracy, and they saw this, and Mr. Lathrop came up, and he was wetter than a wet hen, and he really tore me up one side and down the other, and he says, you know, you almost cost me my job over this. I reported back, well, I think I should have. It should have cost your job. So he realized he wasn't going to get any sympathy from me. The project was stopped.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And I think that was an important role for AVS, or not necessarily stop projects, but to know when the villagers weren't in favor of a project, that it was not a go situation for them, because they had to buy into it and believe in it to make it go.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's one of the advantages we had, of course, of working at the village level and living there. And if you, now, if we'd have been a low-grade aid worker, I would have never been able to do that.
You wouldn't have. If you would have thought about doing it, you would have probably been bounced immediately.
My career would have been over. I was down in Benchon one time, and we had requisition numbers or project numbers, whatever it was, and it usually took an 18-month process to get a project approved, get through the bureaucracy. And of course, IBS only had a 2-year term. And purely by mistake, I was in the office in Benchon, and I said something about we were doing some school construction and dispensary, and I asked him, I said, how are we doing on this certain account? I gave him the number, and a guy goes to the file and he says, well, you haven't used anything yet. So I immediately shut my mouth and went back up to Hongsaw, and I said, Jim, we want to do some more of these projects here. We don't have anything charged against our accounts yet. We'll just use this account. And that's the way we did it, and we got some projects started and completed in 3-4 months, and we got our hardware inputs brought up, and we had that account number became a magic account number for us. Because normally you'd have to have a project approved and go through all these stages to get an account to draw commodities against.
Yeah.
But they had already had this project established in Hongsaw. They had already drawn economies, the commodities against it, but someone made an error and did not charge it to this account number. So we still had this whole...
You had this complete balance.
We had a balance to use, so we used it and probably did maybe underhandedly, but we probably had a better utilization of taxpayers' money than would have been otherwise.
Well, yeah, at least in some other programs. Yeah. I'm just checking the length of the tape on this side, where I think we're going to run out fairly soon here, but we'll keep on going until that happens. To some extent, you did enumerate some of the projects that you were working on. It's still going. Good. So it was the IR-8 rice in Hongsaw. Was the livestock in that area too?
Officially, I was there as an agriculturist to work the IR-8 rice. Unofficially, on our own, we had livestock projects.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Archard started a lot of these before I got there, and we had rabbits, we had chickens, and we had a boar pig.
That's it.